It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. And now, he's a New York Times best-selling fantasy writer, he's a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fanatic, and he's got one of the most impressive beards in Wisconsin. Patrick Rothfuss is with us. Patrick, thanks for joining us for this week's Geek Out segment.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, what is on your mind this week, Patrick?
Well, one of the things, I was just at a convention, and I was on a panel that I really enjoyed. It was called, Does Storytelling Matter in Video Games? And this is an issue that's kind of near and dear to my heart, as I'm a lifetime video game, computer game player, and kind of a storyteller in every sense of the word.
And you're a novelist, so obviously you're thinking about the arc of it and the flow of a story. Is this something that video game designers are just starting to think about, or has this been a big question for a while?
Well, actually, I think it's something that used to happen a lot more often in video games kind of back in the day. Some of the very, very first games I ever played had really good narrative arcs, kind of for the same reason that a lot of early Hollywood movies had really, really good scripts. Because that's all you had. You had actors and scripts. And you did $1 million of special effects just wasn't an option. So you really worked on the story. Video games used to be the same way. In the early days, it was just text. Some of the very first games I played were called, specifically, they were called interactive fiction. And I played those starting in the fifth, sixth grade, and for years afterwards, it really was a formative experience for me.
Isn't there a challenge as a writer or a script writer? You get to pick where the story goes. When you've got a player involved, how much free will do you give them versus railroading them down a narrative arc?
You know, and that you just hit on like one of the absolute biggest issues. In some ways, it's easy with a novel. A novel is a very established technology, and nobody complains that they didn't get any choices in a novel. That's not necessarily true. Some people do complain.
People do complain.
You don't like the ending. But with video games, it is a whole different medium, and that means you can give the participant genuine agency in a story and the ability to change the outcome. And that it's something that it's a paralyzing choice for some designers because it's not something that existed 30 years ago in any medium.
Well, what games have you seen out there that are really kind of going that extra mile and upping the ante with storytelling?
Storytelling doesn't necessarily link to the ability to steer the course of a story. Portal is a game that at its root is really just an interesting physics game. You're given a gun that can shoot two portals, and you can walk through one and you come out the other. And if one's on the ceiling and one's on the floor, you can fall through one and come out the ceiling. It's a very simple premise, and it could have turned into a fairly simple puzzle game. But the narrative arc in the story is so amazingly compelling, and that's what turned a relatively simple puzzle game into like a really amazing experience for like millions of people. That's one of the best examples I can think of.
I was with you playing the Infocom, those text adventure games as a kid, and I sometimes wonder, we have such amazing graphics nowadays. Do people put more of their focus on more realistic images, more realistic looking violence, wackier gameplay, and not coming up with those simple little things that tell better stories?
I think it is. It's absolutely the case. And you can demonstrate it very easily just by looking at Hollywood again. No one in Hollywood would say, if you say, so can you spend $50 million on special effects? And everyone go, oh, sure, you need that for a big budget Hollywood movie. And then you say, so would you spend $50 million on the script for this? and they'd laugh their ass off because, you kind of get what you pay for. And if you're valuing one over the other, I mean, story is the bones of it all. You know, and it's nice to have a pretty face, but with no bones, you know, you can't go dancing with this thing, to really mix a metaphor there.
We've got a Facebook comment I want to read to you, Patrick. Tyler says, in the past, there were many games that already did surpass most novels in terms of storytelling and imagination, but that was back in the era of NES and SNES. Recent games, with a few exceptions, are too focused on flashy graphics and not as much on story and gameplay. But he goes on to say, I have faith, though. The indie game market is growing, which opens the door for people like me with healthy imaginations to make their own games.
And I think that's absolutely the case, in the same way that indie filmmaking is allowing people to really explore. You know, the technology has become such that you don't need $10,000 for film stock anymore. You can shoot it digitally and make a decent movie. You know, two people working some long hours can actually produce a decent game, and if you want to value story in that instance, you can do that. But it is a little harder to sell that to some of these big budget, you know, game producing studios.
Film critic Roger Ebert famously took on video games. He said they would never, ever compare or have the narrative scope of film. What do you say to what the late Roger Ebert had to say?
Well, I think that I wish I had the time to look up when exactly he made that quote. Because if he made it in, you know, 1983, it's probably a pretty fair assessment given what games existed in 1983. You can't really hold up Super Mario Brothers next to Casablanca and really think that they're doing the same thing at all. But, you know, he was speaking a little bit from ignorance. There's no doubt about that. You know, some of the most incredibly engaging and memorable pieces of storytelling I've experienced have happened in games.
Well, I want to ask you, you know, games in general, there is so much research today about kids' brains and video games, and there are researchers who say we need to take games seriously because they can be a big educational aid. You know, there's a video game center here at the UW-Madison campus. And other people say, you know, it gets kids desensitized to violence, turns them into couch potatoes. And you're a dad. Have you given this some thought about what your gut feeling is on video games?
You know, I could happily engage in a series of like 4-hour symposia on that. Because, I mean, the only truthful, realistic answer to that is that it is so complicated, and anyone who claims that they know the truth and that they really know what's going on is either a liar or like profoundly self-delusioned. You know, I love my little boy. I don't think it's healthy for him at this point to be plugged into a computer game all the time. He needs to experience and learn things about the real world. Am I going to keep him away from games forever? No. I learned so much from. I learned to type because of those early Infocom games. I learned a huge vocabulary, you know, from them. Words that I still use today, and I remember specifically when I ran into them in those games. So, I mean, yes, they're useful. Are they potentially dangerous? Absolutely. They're, you know, people are creating games that are as addictive as drugs. And are they fun to play? Yeah. But, you know, it is fun to do drugs, too, I hear. And, you know, it's a bad analogy, but yeah, I can't give you a straight answer there. It's so complex, and there are a lot of very good arguments and some very good science on both sides.
Patrick, we've heard some research that suggests that public radio people are not always video game people. If you had to suggest just a game or two in our last 30 seconds or so to maybe warm people up to the idea, where would you point them?
You know, it's a little tricky. The first thing that I'd say is sort of like if I was trying to recommend a book. I can't recommend a book that everyone out there is going to like. What I would say is all of you out there have some sort of friend that plays video games. I would ask that person, in the same way that you'll get a much better book recommendation from a friend, you'll get a better video game recommendation from a friend. They know you so much better. But I will say there are brilliant games out there, both storytelling and non. Even the ones that don't have a strong narrative arc can be brilliant problem solvers. I mean, that's one of the main things that these games can teach children and that I learned growing up. You learn problem solving like nobody's business playing some of these games.
Well, Patrick, thank you so much for being here. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Patrick Rothfuss, the best-selling author of The Name of the Wind, the first book in his trilogy.
Coming up, our guest takes stock of Iran's nuclear ambitions and whether the U.S. has a responsibility to stop them from getting the bomb. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
When it comes to foreign policy, most eyes have been on Syria for the past 3 weeks.
But there is another country that many in the national security arena have their minds on, too.
That's Iran. Some even argue that the importance of upholding the red line on chemical weapons in Syria has more to do with maintaining credibility with Iran than it actually has to do with the Syrian civil war. That credibility, they say, might be needed to persuade Iran not to build nuclear weapons.
Middle East expert Kenneth Pollack says that Iran is indeed on the path to obtaining nuclear weapons. And while this isn't ideal, the U.S. should focus more on containing a nuclear Iran than actually preventing it from getting the weapons.
Ken Pollack joins us now. His new book is Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in 2002, your book, The Threatening Storm, you made the argument for military intervention in Iraq to prevent Saddam Hussein getting nuclear weapons. In Unthinkable, you say Iran might get nuclear weapons. You're not making the case that war is the best answer to prevent that. Why? What's different from this about this situation?
Sure. Well, the first point to note is that, of course, I have learned a few things from our experience in 2003 and thereafter. And I try to weave those different lessons all throughout this book. But I think more fundamental, the difference this time as opposed to last time is that when I was looking at Saddam Hussein, and of course I believe the intelligence, like so many other people did, that he had reconstituted his WMD program. And I'll also say that the humanitarian suffering of the Iraqi people also weighed heavily in my thinking. But for me, the most important thing was Saddam himself. Saddam was an incorrigibly reckless aggressor, someone who we had seen behave in suicidally reckless fashion. And that kind of person could not be allowed to have nuclear weapons. And so when our intel community and the intel communities of most of the rest of the world all concluded he was, in fact, rebuilding his nuclear arsenal, would have a bomb within somewhere between 4 and 7 years, my feeling was that is not a situation we can allow to have happen. We need to do anything about it, including an invasion. And one of the points I make on Iran in the book Unthinkable, my new book, is, look, the Iranians are not Saddam Hussein. Yes, they are nasty. They are anti-American. They are anti-Semitic. They are murderous. These are not nice people. They do not mean us well, but they are not suicidally reckless. What we've seen from them over the years is they actually are quite rational, pragmatic, even prudent in their decision making. They push us. They try to figure out where our red line is. They try to come up right to the red line. Occasionally, they get a little bit over it. But what we've seen consistently is when they realize they've crossed a red line, they pull back. And that suggests that containment is a very real alternative to war. And in the case of Iran, what I fear is that if we start down the path of war with Iran, we are going to wind up finding that the only solution to the problem is an all-out invasion along the lines what we did in Iraq. And I don't think anybody is interested in doing that. And I think, again, in the case of Iran, that would be unnecessary.
At the other end of the spectrum, you say there's another wrong answer, and that's negotiation only. Why can't we negotiate Iran out of a nuclear weapons program?
Sure. And let me be very clear about this. I am not opposed to negotiations with Iran. In fact, I am wildly in favor of them. I say over and over and over again in the book that we have to be willing to negotiate with them. Negotiating an end to the settlement with Iran is the right answer. What I argue is not the right answer is giving up the sticks that we've been using. What I argue for is that we have to use both carrots and sticks. And there was an argument in number of years ago that said, we should give up all the sticks. We should only use carrots, just give the Iranians positive inducements. And what I do in the book is I trace the history of our interaction with Iran, and I bring in the history of lots of other situations that have been similar to Iran's, both on this and other issues. And on this particular issue, the point that I make is, look, it just doesn't work to try to use only carrots, only positive inducements with a country like Iran. It really has never worked. But what we found is that if you use a combination of the two, you actually can get what you want. My real criticism of the Obama administration, which I think has wielded the sticks extremely skillfully, is I actually think that they haven't been forthcoming enough with the carrots, with the Iranians. The truth is they really haven't put a whole lot on the table for the Iranians in terms of things that we could do for them if the Iranians were willing to give up their nuclear weapons programs. And that's where I'd like to see us be a lot more forthcoming. So I believe in carrots and sticks, and I actually think we need to do a lot better on the carrots part, not the sticks part.
We can dig a little deeper into that, the carrot and stick approach in a bit, but let's do a little more scene setting. Where is Iran, as far as we understand from the outside, with the nuclear weapon program?
Sure. And the way that you put that, Rob, is very important, which is we have to remember, and this is one of the lessons of Iraq, our information is always imperfect. Yes, we do have IAEA inspectors, but they don't know everything that's going on. As best we can tell, the Iranians are probably about a year away from having a nuclear weapon from a decision to go after one. And that's an important point, because a lot of people just, you know, they bandy these time frames around, and people assume that, you know, it means a year from this day. So in other words, September 10th, 2014, the Iranians will have a nuclear weapon. That's not what the estimate is. What the estimate says is the Iranians have gone far enough that if their supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, the Ayatollah, said, I want a nuclear weapon as fast as you can get it for me, they could probably have one in about a year. Now, that's not what they're doing, though. They're not going hell for leather for a nuclear weapon. What they're doing is slowly accumulating stockpiles of both low-enriched and medium-enriched uranium. They are developing the capacity to enrich it faster. And most countries believe they also have a smaller secret program to actually build the physical bomb itself. But that's still a far way away from actually having an arsenal. At best, they've got what's called a breakout capability. But again, as I talk about in the book, there is a world of difference between having a breakout capability and having an actual arsenal. Japan has a breakout capability. No one in the world is afraid of Japan nuking them.
Well, here's a big, even more complicated question. If Iran did get a nuclear arsenal, what would they want to do with it?
Another great question, another question I explore in depth in the book. And of course, the answer to that is we really don't know. There are lots of different Iranians who have posed very different answers to that question. And what's really unclear is exactly what the supreme leader wants. I think it's pretty clear that he wants to have nuclear energy. There's a matter of prestige for him there, and that's important to the Iranian people. It also does seem like the Iranians would like some kind of a nuclear weapons capacity for defensive reasons. Let's face fact, the Iranians are paranoid. They're not crazy to be paranoid. There are a lot of people out there trying to get them. Of course, most of the people who are trying to get them are doing so because the Iranians threaten them and in some cases attack them. But nevertheless, the Iranians don't see it that way, and they do feel like they're in danger. So there's some defensive element as well. We've heard a number of Iranians, though, espouse more aggressive rationales for having it, basically wanting a nuclear weapon so that they won't have to worry about an American or an Israeli conventional military retaliation if they decide to become much more aggressive in terms of terrorism and subversion and support for insurgencies and things like that. That, of course, is the much more dangerous rationale for Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. But, you know, even still, that's something we want to guard against. It's a great reason to not want Iran to have a nuclear weapon at all, but in my mind, that's an important kind of boundary to the problem. That's a problem for the region. It doesn't strike me as a big enough problem to justify going to war.
What, given our limited understanding of the leadership of Iran, just briefly, is it just the supreme leader making this decision, or are there other power centers we have to think about? In just a minute, by the way, before we go to our news break.
Sure, absolutely. Iran is a very fragmented place. There are a lot of different people who have a say in policy, and all of them are important. But at the end of the day, it is the supreme leader who calls the shots, and he's going to be the one who makes the final decision.
We're talking to Ken Pollack about his new book, Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. He's an expert on the Middle East and Persian Gulf, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-643-1234 if you have a question.
That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Continuing our conversation now with Ken Pollack with the Brookings Institution. His new book is Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy. Ken, we'll get back to Iran in just a moment, but I didn't want to let the time go by without asking you about the news today in Syria. Possibly a diplomatic resolution, maybe out of nowhere. Syria gives up its chemical weapons. What do you think the prospects are there?
Well, on the one hand, I think they're reasonably good because I think that the White House had really gotten themselves into a bind. They had gotten themselves into almost a no-win situation with Syria, and this creates the opportunity for them at least to get out of the short-term situation that they had put themselves in. That said, I worry that they may have gotten themselves out of a box, but maybe they're getting into just another one, maybe a longer-term one. You know, the problem here is that we're going to if this works, we will wind up with a kind of a inspections and disarmament regime for Syria a la Iraq. And obviously, on the one hand, we should remember that that worked. You know, I was at CIA and at the White House during that time period trying to make that all work, and it turned out, although we didn't know at the time, that had worked. Saddam did get rid of his weapons of mass destruction, and that ought to give us some hope that it could work for Syria. The problem is that we need to remember that it took 5, maybe even 6 years, we're really not sure exactly how long, before Saddam was willing to give up his weapons of mass destruction even after the Gulf War. You know, maybe Bashar will be smarter and do so faster. But we should also remember that, you know, it was incredibly difficult to do with Saddam, and that was in a situation where there wasn't a civil war going on. I think it's going to be very difficult to make this kind of a tricky inspections and disarmament regime work in a situation where one of the sides is involved in a horrific civil war, you know, raging all across its country. That just opens up any number of different potential problems out there. So, you know, hopefully maybe a short-term solution, but perhaps not a long-term solution.
And there's an Iranian connection to this story we heard on Friday, communications saying Iran wanted its assets in Iraq and elsewhere to attack American interests in the event of an American military strike in Syria. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting piece of information. And let's just add a little bit more to it, which is that this apparently was the intercept of a conversation by a man by the name of Qasem Soleimani, who is the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Quds Force. That's the part of their Revolutionary Guard that does the terrorism, that helps the insurgents around the world, that does all that kind of nasty stuff. He is the hardest of the hardliners. And so on the one hand, look, this may be absolutely accurate, and it may be that the Iranian government, the Iranian regime, has decided if the U.S. attacks Syria, by God, we're going to make sure that the Americans pay a price for it. The obvious way to do it is to have their proxies in Iraq, and they have a lot of them, go after American assets in Iraq. By the same token, I think there are at least two other explanations out there that are just as valid and really important, both to understand the situation in Syria and to understand Iran more broadly, which is, first, this may be something that the Iranian government leaked deliberately to make sure that the U.S. picked it up, not because they actually planned to do it, but just to deter us from going ahead with the strike because we might fear that these kind of things would happen. And so I think it's actually quite unlikely that the Iranians would retaliate, but they might want to make us think that we are, and or that they are. And then the other possibility is this might be something that Qasem Soleimani and the hardliners are doing on their own to make it very difficult for the Iranian regime to go ahead and open up nuclear negotiations, which, of course, Iran's new president wants very much to do. Somebody like Qasem Soleimani probably opposes that entire initiative, and this may be his way of scuttling any negotiation with the United States. So a very complex government, one that's very difficult to read, but unfortunately it's one that we don't have the luxury to ignore.
Speaking of the new president of Iran, he said earlier today, just saw it before we came on the air today, actually, he said, quote, "The period of time for resolving the nuclear issue will not be limitless. The world should take advantage of this period and the opportunity that our nation created in my election." So he says, hey, I've got a little wiggle room after my election. We need to get some nuclear negotiations going now. What do you make of that?
Yeah, again, a very interesting statement by Rouhani. And the way that I read it, and again, one of the things you learn about Iran is we never quite know what the Iranians are thinking. And typically anything they do is open to multiple interpretations. And oftentimes they're valid interpretations. My interpretation of that was Rouhani really would like to see an agreement with the United States. I think he really would like to make some far-reaching changes in Iran. But he's only the president, and I say that semi-ironically. There are other power players in Iran. Obviously, there's the Supreme Leader, there's the Revolutionary Guards, lots of other power centers, many of whom are probably intent on blocking him. And I think what he is signaling is, look, if you want me to actually be able to strike this deal with me, you've got to give me some things to work with, because there are a lot of very powerful forces inside my own country who are lined up against me. And if you guys aren't going to be forthcoming right from the get-go and give me some things to work with to be able to show my regime, the rest of my regime, that, you know, hey, I am making progress, the Americans are taking me seriously, they're making significant concessions to me, I'm going to be dead in the water real fast, and then this is going to go nowhere.
So we're kind of coming full circle to where we started. You said the stick alone, the threat of war, isn't the right answer. The carrot alone, negotiations, isn't the answer. What would the carrot and stick approach look like to trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon?
Sure. Well, again, I think that we've done well on the stick, and it's the threat of war. It's also the sanctions, and I think that the sanctions have had a very profound impact. I think that they're an important reason that the Iranians are coming back to the table. I think they're even part of the reason why Rouhani was himself elected. Where we need to do more, as you point out, is on the carrot side. And there, what I'd like to see us doing is putting stuff on the table the Iranians want. So a peaceful nuclear program, peaceful nuclear reactors to generate energy, something that they want. Security guarantees, something that they want. A seat at the Middle Eastern table, be part of the international relations of the Middle East, something that we've consistently denied them. And then the last piece, and in some ways I think the biggest and most important to the Iranians, is economic incentives. You know, so far what the Obama administration has said to them is simply, if you agree to the deal with us on your nuclear program, we'll stop sanctioning you, which really is just saying to them, we're not offering you any carrots, we're just going to stop beating you with the stick. What we need to do is to come forward and say, look, we can go beyond that. If you guys are willing to give up your nuclear program, if you guys are also willing to, by the way, halt your support for terrorism, there's a lot of things that we can do for you. We can give you trade credits. We can give you investment guarantees. We can give you help securing loans from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. There are lots of ways that we can actually not just take the sanctions off, but help stimulate your economy, bring in direct foreign investment, bring in trade, all the things that the Iranian economy desperately needs, and honestly, all the things that the Iranian people most want.
I want to wrap up by asking you a big question about what Iran wants. I see a lot of possible motivations. Is it exporting the revolution, the Islamic revolution of the late 1970s that happened in Iran? Is it being the defender of the Shia faith? Or is it just old-fashioned national interest, trying to be a dominant power in their region? How do all those factor in?
Yeah, again, a great question, Rob. It's actually kind of, it's where I start the book, because it is such a foundational question to understand before we start to consider options with the nuclear front. And again, the honest answer is that we don't quite know, and it varies from individual to individual. So for some Iranians, all they really care about is securing their own country and living good lives. For others, they want desperately to advance Khomeini's Islamic revolution and, you know, expand it to other countries, export it to other countries, as they put it. For other people, it's about Persian nationalism and Iran as a great power. I mean, we should remember Iran was the world's first superpower dating back 2,500 years to Cyrus the Great. And there are many Iranians who to this day believe their country by nature ought to be the most important country in the Middle East and Southwest Asia. And for them, nuclear weapons are a key to that. Still others are very frightened of the United States. And this is part of the problem of Iran, is that they have lots of different motivations. And part of what we're going to have to do as we enter into these negotiations with them is to help them to have a constructive conversation about, all right, at the end of the day, what is it that we really want, and therefore what can we accept? Because the U.S. hasn't really put a deal on the table that was appealing to the Iranians, we've never forced them to confront that question and sort out from themselves what is it that they really want.
Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Ken Pollack with the Brookings Institution. We've been talking about his new book, Unthinkable, Iran, the Bomb, and American Strategy.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with an update on Apple's release of its new iPhone. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Well, the tech savvy among us were watching the wires this afternoon for what's still considered one of the big technology events of the year.
That's right. It's the release of Apple's new iPhone, or should we say iPhones, plural. This afternoon, Apple revealed two new iPhones, and our producer Galen Druk is here to give us a scoop. And it's good to have you over here, Galen.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what's new with the release of these two new iPhones?
So there weren't that many surprises. What is new is that there are two phones. It's the first time that Apple has, you know, branched off and created different models of an existing product of this product. It's done that with existing products before, like the MacBook and the iPod. But this is the first time they've done it with the iPhone. The other big news points are that the iPhone 5S now has fingerprint scanning technology, and there's also an iPhone 5C, which stands for color, but it is the cheaper one.
Define cheaper.
So it's not actually that much cheaper. This is what most people who were watching for Apple's new release of the iPhone, this is what most people were speculating about, how much would it cost. Because here's really the crux of the story. Most people think that the smartphone industry has sort of done, you know, pretty well in Europe and the United States. And in order for them to make really big profits, they have to appeal to emerging markets. And a $650 phone is not really, you know, within the budget of a lot of people in these emerging markets. So in order to compete with Samsung, they had to create a cheaper phone, you know, that would be more accessible. And this cheaper phone, it turns out, is only $550. So It's a lot of people who are watching this are saying, you know, not really cheap enough to compete. However, the costs are different in the United States because most people in the United States get their phones with a contract. So here in the U.S., the cheaper model of the iPhone color is going to be $99.
I'm curious about the colors. I'm thinking back to the acid orange and electric blue of Apple's. You know, remember when they had those really plastic computers? I remember those colors. What are they now?
Okay, so the iPhone 5, both of them now have new colors. So the iPhone 5 color comes in white, blue, yellow, red, and green. And the iPhone 5S comes in silver, gold, and dark gray. So, you know, you can...
I heard it's called space gray.
Space credit, really. Right. I mean, I believe that sounds plausible.
Roughly when are we going to see these actually on the market?
So they're coming out on September 20th, both of them are. And this is actually the first time for Apple that their launch of the new iPhone is going to be an international event. Usually it comes out in the United States before it comes out in other countries. And they've coordinated across the globe this time.
All right. Well, Galen, thanks for stopping by and filling us in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, today at a press conference at the state capitol, two state senators called for redistricting reform in Wisconsin. Democrat Tim Cullen, Republican Dale Schultz say we should look toward Iowa and adopt their method of putting the process in the hands of a nonpartisan agency.
Joining us now is Jay Heck. He's the executive director of Common Cause in Wisconsin, one of the groups involved in today's press conference. Jay, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you and Rob here.
Well, you're in support of reforming the redistricting process in the state. Tell us what's going on with the process we have now. Let's start there and explain what that is.
Well, you know, I think first your listeners need to understand that this is an issue that I don't think many people really thought about very much before this year or even last year. It seems like such an inside the Capitol type of thing. But, you know, what's become evident is that the repercussions of redistricting and how you do it, it just plays so much into whether or not we have competitive elections, even to the behavior of legislators in the Capitol. And the way Wisconsin has done it is the legislature draws the maps. For the last 50 years, we've had split government, so there's always been a compromise, and then it's always gone to the courts. But basically, the maps are drawn by the legislators and their proxies that that draw the congressional and the state legislative lines. In 2011, for the first time, you had one party in control of everything, in this case, the Republicans. And what happened was we had a hugely expensive redistricting affair. It's cost Wisconsin taxpayers $2 million so far to do this. We have less competitive congressional districts. In fact, we have zero competitive congressional districts now in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We have now only 15 of 99 assembly districts that can be considered even remotely competitive, and only 3 of 33 Senate districts. So basically, legislators have chosen their voters rather than the other way around. And as a result of that, citizens don't have much choice at election time. And what they see is increased paralysis, polarization, and acrimony in the Capitol, because the folks that tend to win elections now tend to be of the extremes of their respective parties. And compromise has become a dirty word because legislators and members of Congress don't fear the electorate during a general election, because they don't have to worry about being defeated because their districts are no longer competitive. So it's a bad situation, and we're talking about fixing this for 2021.
Which is a long ways away. I mean, this is after the 2020 census. I mean, that's way down the road.
And the reason it's vital that we do it now, because with every year that we get closer to 2020 census and then 2021, the more incumbent legislators become protective of their own turf and worried about what a change might look like. You know, in 2013, there's a good chance that many of the legislators who are now in office won't be there. Probably a good chance Governor Walker won't be governor. You'll have completely different people in charge. So it wouldn't affect directly many of the people that would pass this now, but it would be great for Wisconsin beginning in 2021, because it would create a system that made much more sense in terms of having communities of interest together. Competitive elections would be the result of this, and I think you would have a dialing down of the incredible polarization of our politics. And by the way, Wisconsin never used to be this way, and then I think redistricting or the lack of good redistricting is what's caused a lot of the problems that we have now.
And Jay, you said that this was incredibly expensive the way we do it now. Why does it come with such a big price tag, the way that Wisconsin has done it?
One word, lawyers. What happens is the Legislative Reference Bureau, which is a state agency, used to do redistricting reform many years ago. But then the leaders of the legislature decided it would be better to use, or more advantageous to them, to hire outside law firms at $300 or $400 an hour to work behind closed doors in secret and draw hyper-partisan boundaries on districts to advantage the party in power. And the cost to taxpayers to pay those law firms, and then the ensuing lawsuits that come out of those the way they've drawn the lines, cost taxpayers an awful lot of money. And what are they paying for? They're paying for less competitive elections and a more polarized Congress and a more polarized legislature.
Now,
so we've got to change it.
As I understand it, this motion to change things about the redistricting process came from editorials that sort of ran in a bunch of Wisconsin's newspapers. Can you give us a real brief history of where this came from?
Sure. Well, the legislation itself began earlier this year, and Senator Dave Hansen of Green Bay, Senator Cullen, Senator Schultz, Common Cause, others sort of united behind one particular reform bill, and we went to the newspapers and we said, look, this is something that's nonpartisan. It would be good for voters. And it was amazing. Three Sundays ago, every newspaper, major newspaper in Wisconsin, on the same day ran editorials not only in support of what we call the Iowa plan, but really more than that, in support of making sure or demanding that the Wisconsin legislature hold a public hearing on this legislation. They won't even do that. They are adamant. They're so opposed to it that, and that's fine. I understand that they're opposed to it, but to deny even a public hearing so that the citizens of Wisconsin have an opportunity to see what this is all about and make up their own minds.
Well, just to give a voice to the opposition here, as I understand it, what Senator Mary Lazick has said is that by putting the redistricting into the hands of a third party, you're removing them from the reach of the voters, and that's a bad thing.
No, in fact, that's ridiculous. Under the plan that we're talking about, the Legislative Reference Bureau works for the legislature, but what they're required to do is draw the lines without partisan consideration under a strict set of criteria. But the legislature still votes on the plan, on the maps, up or down. And to say that legislators should be held accountable if citizens don't like the maps, well, that's ridiculous, because if you've drawn safe districts, no one's going to be defeated if you ask the voters if they were unhappy with a redistricting plan, because they've drawn the districts in such a way that Mary Lazick will never lose, and some of these other people who criticize the system will never lose because they'll never be in a competitive election. So that's the problem, and it actually... Senator Cullen had a very good point. It leads to the arrogance that we have when legislative leaders now say we're not even going to allow a public hearing, because they have no fear that in a general election they'll have to face any opposition. And the other thing, Veronica, is if you look at the way they've drawn the maps, and by the way, our friends in Illinois has done the same thing, only the Democrats are in charge. They have completely gerrymandered the state in such a way that Republicans will never be able to get in power there. And it's the same type of arrogance in Illinois as we have in Wisconsin with the legislative leadership. They have nothing to fear, so they're adamant about not changing this system. It's really unfair for the voters of Wisconsin. And keep in mind, we're looking at 2021, so it's not as if this is going to affect their partisan fortunes right away.
All right, we're going to leave it there for now, and we're going to come back and pick up the conversation as we talk with Jay Heck of Common Cause in Wisconsin about efforts to get redistricting reform off the ground. And we want to hear from you. Would you like to see an agency like the Legislative Reference Bureau handle redistricting instead of the party in power? Or do you think the current process is working for us? You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. We'll hear from you right after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.